You're at your old trusty boat. You call Mighty Sparrow. I'm in the city of Mardi Gras.
Welcome to the Sailing Into Oblivion podcast, where we sit down with everyday people who do extraordinary things. I'm your host, Jerome Rand.
Good morning, everybody. Soggy and wet up here. Not a fleck of snow left on the ground. Maybe a few patches. I shouldn't say that. And I'm sure there will be some more coming back soon enough. It is Northern Michigan, after all. Today, we've got a great show. We are entering a new era here in the Sailing Into Oblivion podcast, where I have finally figured out some of the tech and everything. Although, I mean, caveat, I say that, but I screwed up a little bit on this first one with my own audio. So normally I'm always worried about the guest's audio if it's not an in-person podcast. And this time the roles were reversed. Now, I have, since I recorded this show with James Hodge, fellow Westsail owner, comedian. We didn't get into much of the comedy stuff that he does, but he is on Facebook and everything. So James Hodge, check that one out. Very, very funny guy. He and I first started sort of emailing back and forth with questions, things like that. And then turns out that he buys this Westsail up in Tennessee, up in the mountains. The story is really, really great. And he ends up bringing it. He's going to bring it down to the same boatyard that Mighty Sparrow lies at this point. And we're going to be able to, this summer, have some sort of cohabitation, as far as we're both in the same yard and we're both working on the same type of boats and doing a lot of the same projects, actually, too, at least a couple of them. So it's going to be pretty fun. You know, I've got to get Sparrow ready because the stars are starting to align for this next voyage. And, you know, if things do work, then we're going to be looking pretty good for a departure sometime in October, November of 2024. Wow. Even saying that out loud, I get a little excited. The old hairs start popping up on my arms. But yeah, this is a real fun conversation. And again, it was one of those where I was like, man, my audio quality is not good enough to put on the show. But the problem is, James's audio is so good, and his story is great, and his insights and everything. I have to put it up. I have to do it because it'd be a disservice to the time that he shared with your host here, old J. Rome, to not throw it out there. And I promise that the next one, which I've got two other virtual ones coming up, it should sound exactly like we're in the same room, and there are two people that if we can get, hopefully we're going to get Rutherford, and then we've got one other surprise guest. And yeah, I don't know. You know, it was something I went back and forth and tried to figure out whether I wanted to do this, but in the end, I want to make sure that I'm bringing some pretty cool guests with some great, great stories and stuff like that. And I think a lot of it's the time spent up here in Northern Michigan by myself, in between gigs and all that. It makes it a little hard sometimes to come up with the right kind of people that I want to get on the show. And, you know, it's just lonely because it's the right kind of people. I mean, basically people, human beings out there, living, breathing humans. So I want to make sure that things go good and the quality's good. So this one, again, like I said, I wish I would have done one or two things before I did this, but you know, I'm not a tech guy. I'm learning as I go. And one of the cool things though is, yeah, I'm learning about these programs. I'm putting in the effort and trying to get there so that we can really enhance the show and keep going and going and going. So this one is available already on YouTube, where you can actually see the video. So you can see our faces, our little talking heads, if you prefer to listen to it there. But either way, this is my conversation with James Hodge. Before we begin, like I always say, if you want to help support this show, keep the show going like so many of you do, which is absolutely fantastic, consider possibly becoming part of the Patreon page or Patreon family. Excuse me. Jeez Louise. Or as I like to refer to them as the board. We've got some pretty cool stuff going on over there. We've got three of the boardroom episodes where essentially we're talking a little bit more about the life of somebody trying to go and do public speaking and the trips and trying to essentially kind of keep moving forward in life and in this whole sailing into oblivion sort of company that is slowly emerging. So those are pretty fun. And we're going to try and do the first one sometime in March, probably from the BVI. Excuse me. We're going to try and do some live stream Q&As over there on Patreon. So it's definitely worth checking out if you want to help out and support the show. You definitely are now, finally, after years, nice job, Jerome, getting a little bit of something outside of just the great feeling that you're supporting the future adventures and the future of this podcast. For those that don't want to get hooked into any sort of subscription or anything like that, totally understandable. We've got the links for Venmo and PayPal, and those go directly to me. And well, they hit me and they bounce off and go directly to Sparrow. So those are much appreciated as well. Obviously, links for the merch, all the shirts, all that sort of stuff. Still, those are priced down as low as I possibly could get them. We've got the links for the books. We've got all the children's books. We've got the Sailing into Oblivion book and the audio book as well. All that through Amazon link. And then last but not least, if you want to reach out to the show, sailingintooblivion.com. I'm still plugging away. We got a busy week. I'm trying desperately to get the new consulting and sort of not yacht delivery, because that's not exactly what I do, but I want to get an information page on there about going and hopping on board and helping people gain that confidence that they want, whether it's offshore, whether it's coastal cruising, whether it's in the marina, boat handling, all that sort of stuff. Essentially, it's become very apparent to me that I really, really enjoy sharing the knowledge. I'm not an expert. I'm not a accredited sailing school or anything like that. And I actually take a little pride in that. I'm not going to lie. I want to be built on a reputation. But if you're looking, if you're in the situation where, oh, hey, you know what? I might actually just get rid of this boat because I feel completely lost and I have no idea what I'm doing and I'm filled with anxiety every single time I do it. Well, I might be able to help. So we'll see. Who knows? I'm going to try and get that page going up. But if you have any inquiries like that anyway, you can reach out to me through that website, Sailing into Oblivion. Just hit the podcast button and it'll take you to contact the show. Other than that, without further ado, James Hodge, fellow West Sailor, big projects in the future. Here is our conversation. Thanks for listening and we'll see you soon.
Welcome, James Hodge, to one of the first virtual Sailing into Oblivion proper podcast. Thank you for joining us, my friend.
Well, thanks for having me. This is cool. Like, this is cool for me because for anybody that's watching this, I came to Jerome the same way you guys probably did, as a fan of the stuff he's done. Like, I read his book, started listening to the podcast, and then, you know, I bought a West Sail 32 in part because of some of the good words you said about it. And that was like, I had two boats on my list to decide between, that or a Contessa 32. I was like, I gotta have something I can cross an ocean on, even though I'm probably never gonna do that. Like, still, I was like, I need the boat that's that strong. And so I had to go with it, man. And now I have a boat to rebuild.
I know. Well, welcome to the family. You've literally bought yourself a doorstep to the entire planet. That's what I like to tell people who buy these, because literally you can go anywhere in that boat as long as you're ready to do it, it'll take you there. So,
well, like I was explaining to my youngest, I was like, yeah, like anywhere in the world where water reaches, we can get there. And he's like, that's crazy.
I've met some West sailors that buy them and their dreams are like, you know, I want to go down to the island south of Cape Horn. I want to go to the South Pacific for 3-5 years, something like that. And the cool thing is that it is really attainable. And it's funny that you said that about the Contessa 32, because you're a man of pretty large stature. The Contessa has like very little headroom, and it's tiny boat.
But it does sail a little bit better to windward than a West Sailor.
Absolutely. It's described, John Kretschmer describes it as a very sea kindly boat. I've never sailed on one. Have you?
I was on one. I was summer before last. I was on one for about 3 hours. Sails never even went up, and I was bummed out. But most of my knowledge about seaworthy boats comes from books and reading this. I've read all of Kretschmer's stuff. Read your stuff, like John Passmore, Christian Williams. Like I'm such a nerd for just sailing literature in general. And
me
I think
too.
That's kind of how the addiction starts. Like it really is. Like, because you can only sail so often unless you live on the coast and already have a boat. But I ended up I got a Catalina 25 just to really learn how to sail on it. And then I was like, yeah, but this thing, I'm not taking this thing offshore. I need a better boat. So very quickly the transition happened to now I have two boats.
Oh no, that can be a curse, man. That can actually turn into an addiction. I've known plenty of people that start with one, they get the second, and then all of a sudden it's like they lose control, and then they have six, and none of them are getting maintained, and it's like, oh no, what do I do? You just got to start selling them. It's like Facebook Marketplace, quick, get on there.
Well, luckily, my wife won't let me buy more
good
boats.
Man. You got good backup. That's always very important. Well, I'll tell you from my experience, the biggest part about the Westsail 32 and why I was aiming towards that one, amongst a couple others, was essentially the perfect storm. You know, when I really got into the nitty gritty and heard both sides of that story from not only, Sebastian Junger's recount of it, which I don't know, you got to take with a grain of salt, but also from the captain of that boat, his son wrote an account of sort of his side of the story. And man, knowing that that boat could just do all that without anybody on it and make it through the rest of that storm, I mean, it's amazing. And I was just, for me, it's always been, I want to go out there as safely as I can and then make sure it brings me back. And it seemed like the Westsail was definitely the best one for that.
I mean, especially within what a realist, if you've got $400,000 to spend on a boat and equipment and all that kind of stuff, then you can maybe find a boat that's going to do even better than a Westsail. But for a reasonable price for an offshore boat, it's everyone that I've talked to about it is surprised at how reasonably priced it is when it comes.
Yeah.
I mean, they're older boats, but prices vary. Like you were just on one that was probably pushing six figures, versus, mine, which I bought needing to get refit, that I bought for significantly less than that. So.
Yeah. Oh, hey, mine too. I mean, the one that I was on, which is they actually, I've not rechristened it, but they essentially, it was cast as a brand new boat back in 2012 after so much work. I mean, they just built the whole thing, rebuilt it all. And that one, I think when it first went on the market, was somewhere around $160,000. And my Westsail was 40. And most of the ones I see are between, if it's a complete boat and it has sails and the engine works, between 30 and maybe 55,000 or something. That's usually what I was seeing.
I got super lucky with I'll just go ahead and throw that. I got mine for six. Plus I got to pay about four to move it to the coast because the guy who had it before me and engine runs, rigging's good. I got a couple of tanks to replace and I just got the sails refurbished, but the engine's in good shape. It was repowered in 2000. And so still an old, it's still not a new engine, but it's running, everything's running fine on the engine.
What kind of engine do you have in it?
Prima M50, a Perkins.
Oh, okay. Nice.
So basically you have a 52, but it's the older version of the Perkins, right?
Yeah, it's a Perkins 4108. And I believe, I don't even know how you would figure it out if you could find the serial numbers or whatever, because it's so old. The guy that sold it to me said it was a 50 horsepower, which is way more than a Westsail needs. I get to hull speed at about, 1,000 RPMs or 1,100. And yeah, so yeah. I can't even run it at the RPMs that it really wants to run at when it sounds like a freaking freight train down there. So I'd love to get one of those 38 horsepower betas, like the brand new ones. Oh, man.
Eventually, I'll repower it, and that's what I'm going to go with. But, I mean, I feel good about, especially, I mean, because I've gone through the engine pretty much front to back and just checking everything there is really to check, unless you're like a hardcore diesel professional, like which I'm not. And I can't find anything in it that isn't service oriented to fix. So,
oh, nice, nice. You know, well, like, and it's got to have some picadillos though, right?
Of course. Yeah. I've got to get it into good enough shape that I can get it out and really learn the boat better. Because as it stands right now, I've had a chance to take it out on Watauga Lake in Tennessee. For everybody listening, I bought a Westsail 32 at the top of a mountain in Tennessee. It was the strangest place in the world to find it. But it's just sitting. And again, Watauga Lake is a beautiful lake for sailing. It is, but really, you don't want anything bigger than, you know, like a 27 really on that lake. I mean, there are people out there that have like 40 foot boats on it, which is crazy. But it's just way too much boat for that lake. But the previous owner, he had had it on the coast forever, and then he would do the river chain down to the Gulf and then go over to the Bahamas and then bring it back up. And then I guess something like 10 years ago, he was too old to take it like out to the Bahamas, so he just had it moved to this lake. And then he passed away, and his son sold it to me. He didn't have any use for it. So I got a crazy good deal. And even after paying to move it, I'm at like 25-30% of what most people are paying for them. So,
wow. Good for you, man. That's nice. And I mean, I know that we are going to be yard mates pretty soon when you get it down to South Carolina. Yeah, it's going to be cool. It's going to be a fun summer having two Westsails working on them. But you definitely have, in our previous talks, you've got a decent project list coming up, right?
I do. And there's certain things I'm trying to decide. I am trying to decide whether or not I want to keep the teak cap rails or if I just want to glass over them.
Ooh, yeah.
And because it's not bad. And the teak's not even in that bad a shape. It's not all bendy like you see on some of them by the time they actually rip it off. Mm. So the teak's not in the worst shape, but there are some places where water's getting in. And I want it to be as dry as I can get it. And so the internal debate about whether or not I'm going to glass them over is, and that would be the biggest project I'm going to have to tackle. I'm redoing the standing rigging. I'm possibly going to glass over the cap rails and the mast step. I'm going to G10 it up, build it up a little bit because it's got a little sag in it, not much, but yeah. it's got just enough that I'm like, that's something to take care of while I've got the mast off. And I'm rebuilding the bowsprit.
Oh, okay. Wow. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We talked about that. That's a pretty serious right. list. I just heard from a girl, Leela, over in shout out. She'll definitely hear this, but she's over, I believe, in the United Kingdom somewhere, and she's got a Westsail. She's just hauled it out of the water, pulled the mast down, and she's got that sag as well. And I had it on Mighty Sparrow. I know Tiffany, she's a Westsail owner down in the Fort Pierce area. She had that as well. And it's just one of those things where if you, in my estimation, if you start to see the sag, just go for it. You gotta deal with it, or it's just going to start rotting and spreading that rot.
And you think about 50 years of a mast standing up on, like, mine's a 75. Exactly. What year is Sparrow?
75.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, that's a lot of
years. They're like brothers. Oh, they are. That's great. They are. when we get to the yard, we'll have to check our numbers and see how close they are from the factory.
I'm hole 401, I think, off the top of my head. Is it 401? I think it's 401.
I don't know what mine is. I can't remember. Yeah, yeah.
It's stamped on the back, whatever.
Mine used to be stamped on the back, but they glassed over it.
Really?
I had to go down inside of the, when they did the one really nice thing the previous owner did was he had a professional paint job done to the outside of the hall. Okay. And they went and filled all that in and painted over it. And the Coast Guard demands that you have that hall number somewhere, and it's permanent. And so I went in inside the Lazarette with a Dremel, and I Dremeled it all in there.
Nice.
I was like, yeah, well, hopefully that'll do. I don't know.
Government invading you, telling you have to have proof of ownership.
Tell you what, it's my favorite mile marker on any of my trips is, I believe it's 12 miles, and that's when I'm in international waters, 12 miles from the coast.
It's funny. As much as I like to rant and complain about that sort of stuff, I'm glad we have things like the Coast Guard,
because
there are too many dummies, including ourselves, that can get ourselves in trouble. And you know, having somebody show up and just get you, and you don't get a bill for it, it's pretty nice.
It's, dude, and it really is. I mean, having sailed as much as I have up and down the coast on various different boats, I mean, the network of everything from just, you're always hearing the Coast Guard blasting stuff out. You know, there's a problem here. Is anybody close? You just feel like there's this sort of safety net that goes offshore pretty darn far. And it definitely makes a sailor feel a little warm and fuzzy inside to know that that's there. Of course,
you had to be the guy that was like, no, I'm just going to go where there's none of that, though.
Yeah.
I'm going to go spend nearly a year. Just, no, there's no help. What's the point? I've been paying taxes my whole life, so I might as well get as far away from the benefits as any human can get and still be on the planet. I need you to do a new presentation, and your new presentation needs to be the Earth is not flat. Because you're one of the few people that can actually say, I proved it. I've got the mileage. I've got my logbook. I've got everything documenting how many miles I traveled when I did it. And if I went down, and if the world was flat and I actually went and sailed around Antarctica, it would have been double the mileage. And you can prove it. And in today's in 2024, there are enough. You need to go to flat Earth conventions and just walk in and be like, I proved you guys are wrong. You guys are all just idiots.
I am not wasting my time doing that.
Give me 10 grand to give a speech.
I will say, though, it's funny enough. There was some professor on YouTube, and years ago during the whole pandemic and stuff, just devouring YouTube content. And his whole thing was fighting back against flat earthers, and he was using all sorts of garbage. And I ended up actually writing into him and I said, hey, listen, I have all this data from my trip going around the world, distances, times, blah, blah, blah. I was like, if you ever want to make one of these videos and collaborate with me on it, I was like, absolutely. But I never heard anything back. So,
I mean, or you could sponsor another trip around the world by going to the flat earthers being like, guys, I'm going to prove it. You guys are going to buy me Starlink. You guys are going to pay for everything.
Give me some new sales.
Yeah. You guys are going to throw me about 100 grand, and I'm going to go prove that it's 80,000 miles around down there. And then when you get back, you can be like, well, it's science. Thanks for the trip, though, guys.
I do remember a few little comment battles back when I first started doing TikTok videos, and, you know, when it was really small and, you know, you just only get a few comments, so you toy around with it and stuff. But there was one where people kept asking, you know, is the world flat and all that? And I explained how I tell that it's round. And that was that, you know, I can find a ship on the AIS that's 15, 16 miles away, and I can't see it from deck level. And then I climb up my little mast, and I get about 25 feet up there, and now I can see them because I can see just further past the curve of the Earth. And I was like, that's 100% proof to me. I mean, I don't see any, but all you hear back would be like, well, it's refracting the light.
Right,
and,
of course,
you know,
of course. But that's, you should start volunteering to take flat earthers out so they can prove it. Like, no, I'm going to take you off 50 miles and you're going to use your laser that you spent however much on. And then when it hits, like, just completely roll with their nonsense so that you can say, yeah, guys, look, I am willing to be proven wrong here. So I'm happy to take you guys out for 10 grand and you use your laser.
Yeah, I don't know. No offense to flat earthers. People have, you know, they can believe whatever they want, but I can think of a lot of other people I'd rather invite aboard Mighty Sparrow for an ocean passage. You know what I mean? So anyway, well, yeah, I mean, you're back to sort of the projects list and stuff, man. Right. I mean, that the cap rail, that was a big issue on Sparrow for a while because it was leaking all over the place because just that old adhesive or compound that they use ends up rotting away. And I found that finally, after two coats of 4,000, that 3M product, the UV one, that sealed that up finally. And I thought I was in that same mode of like, man, I should just glass over these. I have to say, though, in my opinion and only mine, when I see a West Sail that has a glass rail compared to a wood rail, the wood rail looks so good. Yeah, it looks so good. And it's a beast, man, to work on and to re-varnish. I'm letting mine go gray to match my beard and stuff these days. So we'll see how that goes, because all up until this, I've re-varnished it, stripped it all the way down three times since I've owned it. And that you got to take the stanchions off to do it proper. It is a serious job. So it'll be interesting to see what you end up going with.
Well, mine's already gray. So,
okay. What, the beard really, or the cap rail?
Well, both. because I haven't had it out sailing enough that the rail's dipping in the water, I don't know how much water comes in then. But even just when it rains, there's a couple of spots where after 2 days of rain, I'm filling up about a quarter of a gallon Tupperware thing that catches it.
Okay.
And so, I mean, that alone, like, I want it to be dry enough that at least in that situation, I know you're never going to get a boat all the way dry. It's never going to happen.
No,
you know, so
that really nice one, that one was a wet boat. We found areas that water was getting in behind the seams, and you know, you'd open up a cabinet and everything's got water on it and you're like, ugh, what the heck?
Well, they should call and ask for some of their money back.
No, hey. Well, no, it just goes to show that, yeah, no matter how nice the boat is, you're going to have water intrusion is just sort of a fact of life. But the biggest thing is trying to isolate the areas. I used to have, on that trip around the world, man, for the first month or so, bashing through the North Atlantic, I was chasing down leaks left, right, and center. And by the time I got back and hauled the boat out, pulled everything out of the forepeak, there was actually probably about half a cup of crystallized salt from just constant salt water for 9 months, getting, you know, in there, and then finally just solidifying. I should have kept it. I was like, get this out of here, wash it off. So what are you gonna do?
All right, so what is your next big trip as of right now? Like, what are you thinking you're going to do now? Are you going to try the figure eight again? Or are you like, what's your big next plan?
Right now, it's all in the sort of idea zone where we're spitballing some stuff. I'm trying to finally change my normal game of, I'm going to go make some money for 9 months and then I'm going to spend it all on the boat, go out into the ocean, break the boat because I'm underfunded and I didn't get all the stuff I needed, and then return kind of broke and busted again. I've done that now three times, and it's one of those things where I just can't keep doing it. I'm getting too old to have more like kind of unsuccessful and underfunded trips. Now,
yeah.
I've had some luck as far as upping the financial game a bit, but I know that a trip, if I'm going to do, let's say, the figure eight through the North and South Atlantic, you know, that's going to cost somewhere between $15,000 and $30,000, because I need new sails. The sails is already 10 grand right there. So that's the huge chunk of it. But I'd like to also be able to add not just me going out and sailing, but something where I'm doing the data collection. Because for years, I've watched Matt Rutherford through the Ocean Research Project, and his podcast, Single-Handed Sailing, is great. I've watched him go out and do these data collection trips. He's about to do another one pretty soon. And I was always kind of jealous of that and be like, man, you can sort of add this element to these adventures. And we had talked briefly a few times about the South Atlantic garbage patch, and it's never really been fully surveyed. It's a really isolated ocean in our sort of planet. You know, the Indian Ocean hasn't been surveyed either, but, you know, it's got India there. It's got Southeast Asia. It's got Eastern Africa. I mean, there's a lot of stuff flowing into that. So, you know, it's going to be filled. The South Atlantic, though, doesn't have a huge population around it. So it's kind of one of those where I thought, you know, that'd be like the last bastion of a clean ocean. And I know it's not, because I sailed garbage patch on my trip around the world. So what we're thinking, and we're spitballing these ideas, and I'm working not only with Matt on this, and then also with some of the guys at North Sails to try and do sort of a recreation of that figure eight. Not going to leave for Maine this time, though, because the boat's down in the Cape Hatteras area. Because of that hurricane season and then the autumnal gale season are right next to each other. I just don't want a chance taken off from that far north again. But essentially leave from Hatteras, head out. You know, you got to get pretty much across the Atlantic, go down, cross the equator, the doldrums, be able to skirt your way along the South American coast, and then you can hit the westerlies. And the area of that South Atlantic garbage patch is kind of smack dab in the middle. It's around 25, 30 degrees south latitude, and it's in an area called the South Atlantic High, which is kind of very similar to the Azores High or the Bermuda High, these areas of light winds kind of stuck in the center, but that's where I ran into most of the garbage.
Yeah.
So I'd have to spend about 2 or more months crisscrossing around in these light winds, tracking the data and towing these little nets and things like that, picking up all the data from and trying to find the concentration of the plastic and how bad it is, take the samples, and then go north. Back up around, and hopefully, because something I've always wanted to do is stop at St. Helena, stop at Ascension Island, and then do a couple flybys in the Caribbean, and then back home. So it's, you know, all said and done, it's probably 15,000 miles and maybe 5-6 months to be out there. So I get my little solo adventure and all that, but also be able to do something good for, I guess, the whole world, really, is more data collection on how severe the problem is with plastics. And, you know, it would, if I have teams working with me, like North Sails or the Ocean Research Project, that'll help, because then I could get something like Starlink and have that on the boat and kind of do uploads and things like that. So that's the dream at this point. And essentially, if all the stars align and everything goes okay and we're able to make something work, then it would be essentially taking off at the end of October, beginning of November of this year, and then returning sometime around like April.
I mean, that the only thing I ask is, if you're not going to have Starlink, is you stop along the way so you can, you know, upload videos and some podcast episodes, because I think with your personality, it's charming to watch you on your boat. Like, it's fun because you have such a good attitude.
Thank you, sir.
I mean, like, it really is. I think the most important thing for people that are creating sailing content or really anything, it was when it can be aspirational. And like, your trip around the world was so big. That, of course, we want to read the book about it, but like, sitting down, like, there's no way to, unless you're doing like a multi-documentary, like a series, like a 10-hour documentary.
Yeah.
Series, it's hard to really capture. As much as I liked Rutherford's movie where he sailed around the North and South. Like,
Red Dot on the Ocean. Yeah.
But it was so compact, like, for the amount of time he was actually out there, that it was hard to absorb it. But if you can really document that in segments and sections, and as you're putting it up, people will love that. I think people will really come to that, especially because you're doing it for an incredibly good reason, or you found a good reason to do what you wanted to do anyways.
Yeah, I got a good side reason. The rest is just me. I just want to go sail.
Yeah, sorry, Mom. I'm not getting a real job yet. I'm saving the planet.
Yeah, right. Oh, man.
Send more money.
Well, it is. Yeah, and I think there is something to be said about being able to do that stuff in real time when you're getting that update and it's that day because, I've got called out quite a few times and I try and relay to people that I don't have this sort of capability on my boat. But
right.
They'll be like, dude, this was from like a year ago. Why are you putting this? And I'm like, well, because I was out at sea, man, for those 9 months and I don't have Starlink. To be honest, I had to battle mentally trying to figure out whether or not I want to let the devil onto the boat and have that sort of connection with the world. Because one of the nice parts for me is through experience, I know how good it feels to be disconnected permanently while you're out at sea, and it changes you, how your brain thinks. It changes everything, but you need that no content rushing in at you for a set amount of time, and then your brain just slows down, and it's awesome. It really feels good.
But you can also, in that, you can shut it down for a week.
Oh yeah,
take a day. I don't know. You're bringing people to sailing through the things that you've done. Like, I hope you get that, right? Like, there are people out there that are coming to sailing because of guys like you and, guys like Sam Holmes and those guys. Like, people are getting into this sport, which is, at this point, it's amazing to be out in the Atlantic. I mean, the best I've done is 48 hours offshore, but that's an amazing experience that more people should have. And guys like you are inspiring people to do that. And so anything more you can add to it is just going to be that much better.
Well, and that's I appreciate you saying that, because that, one of the big things that I went back and forth with after the trip around the world was whether or not to upload any of that stuff like onto YouTube or whatever. And, at the end, I just said, well, if I'm not sharing, I'm just sharing my experience, and it might tip somebody in the right direction to just get off their butt and go for it, then it's all worth it. And if I only get one person to do that, then great. Cause I really didn't, I've always felt like I'm walking a fine line between sharing and being like, look at me,
right,
look what
right.
I can do. Wow. Right. And I don't want that. So I definitely appreciate what you're saying. And it makes me want to continue doing it. And I will say, on the boat, the way I rationalized having Starlink on there or making that decision for the future is that, as long as I can control myself and only upload and create and not consume any of it, then, that might be okay. But that's like, sitting a bottle of whiskey down next to an alcoholic and being like, you can look at it, just don't touch.
Yeah, but if you're sitting in the doldrums for 2 weeks, I don't think it's terrible that after 11 days you watch a movie on Netflix.
You can't do that. You can't do it. It takes you, it pulls you out. But that's only me. I think part of it
it's a new experience that you haven't had yet. So now, see, this is just a different form of adventure.
Wow, that's true.
I'm just going to be the devil on your shoulder.
I need that tweet. Yeah, right. Oh, geez.
Feed the algorithm, Jerome. Feed it.
There's something about it. And maybe I'm just weird, but there's something so enjoyable about getting into the mode where you're as excited to open up a book under a tiny little headlamp and all that in your bunk as you would be of like picking up your phone after a week of not looking at any social media. And you know how good that feels. It's like, oh, I've missed out on so much. Well, you got this book and you're reading and your brain is thinking, I don't know, there's something so nice about it, but call me old fashioned, I guess. Right.
Well, one of the big things, like, it's like in the year 2024, the world's, for the lack of a better word, this is high praise, but you're our Bernard Mortissier, you and Rutherford and the things that you guys have done. Cause you're not, doing these races. Like, you didn't do a race around the world where you were back in 60 days. Like, you went out and you, like, you weren't like you're so I feel like the work, the stuff that you're doing and stuff that other guys, ocean crossing sailors are doing right now, somebody's got to be bringing these stories back. And you wrote a book and your book is great, but I'm sorry, if Bernard Mortissier was alive today, he would be posting on YouTube.
Oh yeah, there's no doubt. So, no doubt.
I mean, it's
he actually mentioned a little bit about that, because he did eventually get a some sort of film recorder, and he had wished he had more of that, because he would have liked to have shared it with the world and all that sort of stuff. You know, interestingly enough, in the long way, in the very end of that book, when he finally reaches Tahiti after 300 something days, he goes on a little tirade about like technology and the progression of the future. And he literally, and this is back in 1969, I believe, talked about, he says that someday everybody's going to have a little device in their hand that they can then go ahead and talk to everybody else on the planet with, and it's not going to be a good thing. And it's like, oh, he called out the cell phone already.
I mean, people are always afraid of the future. Like last night, my wife, she works in tech and in development. And so a lot of the platforms, then companies that she works with, they're starting to bring in ChatGPT and different AI forms. My brain, which is similar to yours, like my brain initially is like, oh, all the ways that's going to be dangerous. It's like, oh, do we really need these people make it? And it's, and of course, so my default reaction is always to be like, oh, new technology's bad. But at the same time, man, I love an iPhone. I do. It's
pretty helpful. Pretty helpful.
It really is. It's amazing. We have a thing in our pocket that knows basically somewhat of an answer to every question that doesn't involve philosophy. You know, it's true.
Well, and it's kind of funny. I think of it, you know, from like a safety standpoint, it's awesome. You know, think about using going on a road trip. It makes it very easy to navigate. You're not going to get lost. If you do get lost, you can get back. You can call for help, all that sort of stuff. Funny thing though, I remember doing a road trip with my sister-in-law, Ina, guest of the show way back in the day, and she had never used an atlas for like a road map. And we were going from South Carolina to Michigan. And when I picked her up at the airport, I was like, guess what? We're going to try something new. I was like, phones off. You're the navigator. I'm going to drive. And here's your atlas. And literally, she just looked at me like, what? Are you kidding me? And
Right? Holding up a giant map while you're going 70 miles an hour down the interstate. That's so much safer than
she's the navigator. That's the thing. I'm driving, she navigates. And, you know, after a couple of bumps here and there and going through a couple of cities with some construction, she literally was having so much fun pulling that atlas out and being like, oh, okay, we're coming up to Detroit. Let's see if we can find this route and da da da. And I was like, see, that's the snap. You just don't get that. If the phone gives you the answer, you never get to experience the actual fun of learning and utilizing this ancient technology.
And that's like, I mean, I grew up obviously with maps, because I think you and I are about the same age. You might be like a year younger than me. How old are you?
45.
Oh, no, we're the same age. Okay.
Oh, so, nice.
Class of 96.
Class of 97.
Baby. But yeah, so like my dad was a truck driver. I grew up with the big road atlases and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I came to sailing, like navionics and all that kind of stuff were there. So I just use them.
And right.
But I mean, I also, you know, anytime I'm someplace new, it's let's get the paper chart. Let's go through and make sure we got it all. One of the places that I'm going to long term keep the boat in the Albemarle Sound, if you don't zoom in on navionics, you don't see the power line that goes all the way across the Albemarle Sound, but you see it on a paper chart. So it's, I mean, when you're out in the water, you'll probably see the power line. But if you don't go over the center section of it, there are parts on the sides that are under 50 feet.
Yeah. Well, and that rings true. The old saying of, you know, you never want to just use one aid to navigation.
Right.
They even say that on a lot of the charts and stuff. And, you want the paper chart, you want the Navionics, you want the GPS plotter, all that sort of stuff, because they're just layers of defense. Yeah. I think one of the big things that some people don't really understand about the world of sailing and yachting is that, you know, when things go really wrong, your boat sinks and you quite possibly die. It's not like you get a flat tire and you pull off the side of the road. Like, if stuff really hits the fan, you're going down and you lose everything. And so
people die in cars too, Jerome.
I know they do. I know, but not for, you know, navigation, you know, mistake. Well, no, I shouldn't say that. I guess they do. They totally do.
Like, people trust their GPS and drive off bridges, man. Like, it's
it is true. You know, people always love to point that out to me when I do presentations and stuff. In the end, we usually do a Q&A and all that, and somebody inevitably would be like, "Hey, you realize that statistically it was more dangerous for you to drive to this presentation than it was to sail around the world." And I'm like, "You got me there for sure."
Well, I don't know. I would guess. Let's see, how many people have attempted, do you know how many people have actually attempted a nonstop circumnavigation?
Oh, thousands, tens of thousands, probably.
Oh, it's so can't be many tens
people.
Of that. Can't be
oh,
tens of
yeah. People, it's one of those dreams that people, non-stop, every single year, non-stop. Every single year, there's people
have navy, but a nonstop circumnavigation. Is it, you really think it's 10,000?
People have been attempting it since 1969,
right.
And literally every year there's more and more people that attempt it, and most of them don't make it very far at all before they come right back.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I know of, I wouldn't call them out by their names or anything, but yeah, I know of probably at least off the top of my head, like 10 or 15 just over the last, you know, decade. And there's probably so many more because it's such a, I don't know, enthralling sort of challenge and dream for anybody who's on a sailboat. I challenge any sailor not to at least think about it for a second of like, ooh, could I make it around the entire world?
I'm pretty sure rounding Cape Horn is more dangerous than driving to a presentation. I just that like, maybe be. I'm wrong. Maybe yeah, I'm
who
wrong.
Knows, who, like, knows, who knows?
Maybe that's me over romanticizing the dangers of the Southern Ocean, but I've never been in a car where like I was at least on multiple occasions being like, oh, we almost went over that time. Like,
yeah. I've had a few close calls in cars in Northern Michigan in the wintertime, you know, skidding out at high speed and stuff. But, you know, cars are just such an amazing thing, though, because you're driving so fast and you are so close to opposing traffic. And the only barrier is a little yellow line. And I know there's been actually books written on like the mindset of people in traffic and how it all works and why it works. Cause really it shouldn't, it should be such mad chaos out there on roads with people, you know, everybody's got their own attitude, their own opinion and da da da. But boy, I think it's the fear of death that keeps people in line on a road.
Nope. It's the, we're way more sheep than we admit.
Oh, like, and
human beings are willing to stay in line way more than most people want to admit. I think that's what it is. I think it has more
herd mentality.
People are so unfocused when driving that they're only probably using 60% of what they would do just to walk down the street. I mean, how focused are you when you drive? I mean, you're focused, but you're not.
I'm
locked in.
If I'm in heavy traffic, the only caveat I have is that since becoming a motorcycle rider, that changed how I drove cars like immediately because I just became so much more aware. But
the focus on your motorcycle is so much different than in a car, even after
it transfers right over, though, for me at least. I mean,
I still drive like I drive. I mean, I'm more cautious. I'm more cautious of motorcycles just because I've having been cut off and have those experiences where somebody was on their phone and just comes merging over and
I'm just sitting there.
Like, and that's a, so I am more cautious in that way, but it's still that mindset you get into when you're just driving on the interstate for 5 hours. I mean, you're basically 80% asleep.
I'm just gonna say just from my own experience, and I believe in what you say that the vast majority of people are definitely. But I just got off of a 2-day road trip, 20 hours or something, and I am hyper focused because I just know how fast that can all go wrong, and I feel very cooped up when I'm in a car because you have all these blind spots that you don't have on a motorcycle. And so, when I switch lanes on a highway, I literally put my blinker on and then I turn my head and look, check the mirror, and then I go. And
next time you're on the interstate in the car as a passenger, pay attention to how
the
driver actually is. And I think you're like, oh, James might have been right on that
one. Like I said, hey, I believe you on that. I mean, most people text and drive, and I've never that's one where if I'm in a car and I'm a passenger and the driver does that, I'll let him have it. I'm just like, dude, it's my life too, pal. I give me that phone. I'll rip it out of their hand and I'll read FaceTime their text.
I don't give a shit.
Oh, God almighty. Don't tell people that.
I don't really. Shit. I mean, I have set my phone down in FaceTime. I try not to hold my phone up and actually.
Yes, please do. Good man. Good man. All right. Well, we've gone off the rails here a little, but I know you had some serious transportation woes, and this is definitely always a question for a lot of people. Is like, well, if I need to move a boat over the land, well, how does that all work? Can you go through some of the issues you had?
Okay, so first off, tracking down a boat mover that I didn't know how much I didn't know pricing, any of this kind of stuff when I started looking into it, but I had heard a few good references over in where the boat is right now about a particular moving company, and I am not going to in any way disparage him. I'm not even going to mention the name of the company, but he had multiple instances where he had truck issues and had to cancel last minute the move. And he was a one-stop shop, so it was great. He came, he took the mast down himself because he has a crane built onto his truck. So mm-hmm. He lowers the mast, he loads it, lowers the mast, does all of it, and then he'll even restep your mast himself when he gets you to where he's delivering it. So I was like, that's the guy to go with, right?
Yeah.
After multiple occasions of him having truck issues and not being able to do it, the guy that he was supposed to move the week before me, so actually like this week right now, and me, he put us in contact. And I got really lucky because that guy is a logistics specialist. And so he, in a matter of a couple hours, tracked down a moving company, a rigger, and a crane company to come out and get the mast down. Because his mast... there's no shrouds on it. It's just one of the big 800 pounders.
Yeah, freestanding.
Yeah. So he had to get a crane anyways for his. And so we're all going to, but it ended up being a little bit more expensive, but at the same time it's getting done. And it was stressful though. Cause you're all set and ready. Like I went down, I took the bow pulpit off. I've got all the lines taped down and wrapped to the mast. So, all the instructions they say when you're going to move it and all that. So I'm all set. And then he cancels. And then he's like, it's going to be 3 months. And so we get rescheduled and then cancels again. And it's very stressful. But the main thing I would suggest for anyone going into this is go into it with patience. Go into it with, do a lot of research on the company that you're going to work with and understand that you're probably going to be better off if you bring in a rigger, if you need that. Like, I guess if you moved Sparrow, you could just re-rig it yourself, right?
Yeah, I mean, I can do quite a bit, but I would need the boatyard to, utilize their crane.
Right.
And have them hoist it, and then I'm up there, wrenching away. But most boat yards, like when I purchased Sparrow, we had to move it from this guy's backyard, 30 miles to a boat yard. And that was, I don't know, I think they charged me like $700, something like that. And then the boat yard puts the mast up while it's still on the rig. Then they throw it in the lift and they put it in the water. All said and told, for a 30-mile trip was just over $1,200, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. And It depends. I know the transportation of a yacht depends on, is it multi-state? How many miles is it? All that sort of stuff. So,
well, I'm lucky because they're bringing mine down from the top of a mountain all the way to the coast of North Carolina, from Tennessee to the coast of Carolina, mast down. I'm not putting the mast back up when it gets there because I got to redo all the wiring and the mast. Yeah. I'm probably going to replace all the rigging. Not probably. I'm sure I'm going to replace all the rigging. So I'm not having the mast go right back up anyways because I got to do the bowsprit and all that stuff. So it's all in all, it's a little over four.
And oh, okay.
Some people were quoting as much as 7,500. One guy was like 10 grand. I was like, what? Mm-hmm. So I, pricing wise, but part of the reason why the price is as good as it is the guy that was supposed to be moved the week before me, that we're now tag teaming it together. So some of the expenses of bringing the rigger out, we're splitting in half. Nice. The crane fee, we're splitting in half. And because the truck is picking him up on the coast of North Carolina and bringing him to Watauga Lake, and then picking me up at Watauga Lake and bringing me back to Bellhaven, there's no deadhead miles either. So,
gotcha.
So that also got cut out. So that was part of the reason why the price ended up being pretty reasonable. But
nice.
I also tend to try to get the most I can out of my dollars.
Yeah. Hey, no, you have to. I mean, you know, as a boat owner, you know, bring out another 1,000 is a mantra we all have to live by. But if you can find a way to pinch the pennies here and there, yeah, it's definitely not a bad idea. Yeah.
I'm not going to pinch pennies on rigging. I'm not going to pinch pennies on, like, I got an Aries, but I got one of the old flip up ones. And
oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The reason I got it, I really like the idea of being able to get it all the way out of the water. Plus I got a really good price on it. And so I am sending it to Aries and they're going to completely redo it. Like top to bottom, completely.
Oh, really?
It. Right. Right. And even with the price I paid for it, shipping it to them, having them rebuild it and ship it back is still half of what a brand new one costs. So,
wow, we're going to have to talk deets on that one because Mongo only needs a few areas where the like bushings need to be replaced and stuff. And they sent me, it was the coolest thing. I couldn't even believe this. I purchased mine in 2017, brand new, right? Yeah. And at that point, it was just a shade over $5,000. Including all the taxes and the customs fees, duty, all that. And it was like 3-4 years later after another 50-60,000 miles had gone by and I needed to replace a few of the bushings. And essentially I just wrote to the quick email and I was like, hey, you know, I've got a few of these things worn out, da, da, da. Can you let me know how much it costs? And he was like, don't worry about it. I'll send it to you right away. And I just get this little package and it's got all the stuff. He didn't charge me a thing. Like that company's awesome. Shout out to Aries.
I mean, cause I was emailing back and forth with them, for the full rebuild. I mean, they're basically charging $65 an hour plus whatever parts they need to add into it. And he said, we always get it done within 2 days. So, you know, 16 to 18 hours of labor. I mean, plus I bought the thing for $1,000. So grand total, even with shipping, we're looking at around $3,000 and a new one, including the customs and everything, is almost $7,000 now. Even without customs or anything, they're $6,000.
Hey, they're plus worth shipping, it. They're worth it.
They are. And so I don't know if I'm going to get you to come offshore with me, but I'm definitely going to get you to come spend a couple afternoons out in the bay where you're teaching me how to use that thing.
For sure.
Like, what's your hourly rate?
That's the nice part about TJ's is that, and I guess, you know, giving away where it is, but that's all right. TJ can always use the business. It's a great boatyard, but they have, you know, they've got slips there. They're not that, it's not very deep. But just outside of there, you've got some pretty good open sailing ground. I forget what the river is. Like the
Pongo River?
Yeah, the Pongo River. Yeah.
And
then
that leads up to the Alligator if you're going north, and then down to the Noose and all the rest, and Pamlico if you're going south.
Right, right. I think the only drawback to being that far in, at least from my perspective, is that when I want to get back to the ocean, it's going to take me a couple of days.
Yeah.
Those canals, and it's always slow. I mean, I somehow and miraculously, because I was so exhausted after the last little trip from South Carolina up. I'd spent like 6 days offshore, kind of did an unusual route to get up there because I was testing the replacement equipment and all that stuff. But I was exhausted. They were playing these war games out in front of Beaufort. And so I had to avoid them. And then the winds picked up. I was real uncomfortable. I hadn't slept in like a day. And then I'm pulling in and I have like miles and miles of canals to go just to get into like Oriental. And it took all day. I had somehow, though, hit the tide perfect. Speed over the ground the whole day was like 6.5, 7 knots. And I was just like, oh, thank goodness. But that's the one thing that's a drawback, though, as opposed to being up in Maine, is that, you know, Maine, I freaking untie that line. I'm pretty much in the ocean in 12 hours. I'm in the Gulf of Maine, at least, and ready to just see nothing but waves.
I'll tell you what, though, this fall, if a named storm makes landfall on the East Coast, you're going to be glad to be for your
that far in
and not down in Beaufort, or, you know, it is a massive difference how much those storms weaken just coming across the Outer Banks and through the Sound and making landfall. Cause it's
true.
I mean, it's going from, you know, I mean, a friend of mine growing up, his uncle, his beach house was in Surf City, North Carolina. And I mean, it just wiped out the entire island of houses, just gone. And then 50 miles inshore, trees are down and stuff. There's some damage, but the wind's literally, you're almost cutting in half just from the time they hit the coast to the time they get up to Bellhaven, and you can sail it. So,
yeah, no, it's true. It's true. I mean, and that's something that, you know, back in the day, I was always going back to Maine, so I just didn't have to think about it. Now, I know they got hit by a pretty massive storm this last hurricane season. It wasn't crazy up there, but it was pretty bad. But yeah, as a sailor, as a boat owner now of an East Coast boat, that's like a big thing you have to think of. It's like, where are you going to keep your boat during the peak of that hurricane season?
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, this will be the second year mine will be sitting there in the Carolinas, which, you know, it's right in the target zone, really.
Well, I mean, at this one, it's usually a pretty good stretch between years when one makes direct contact to the Carolinas. God, Florida gets hit about once a year.
Jinx us up so I know, bad. I know. Oh,
no, 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 knock no. On some I am wood. I am a North Carolina guy, man. I have been hitting hurricane parties since I was 14 years old, dude.
Good man.
Hurricanes just don't scare me the way that they scare people. Like, you grew up, like, a blizzard scares me. No. The way a blizzard scares me. Like, and you can go through a blizzard and you're like, I mean, it's cold, but it's fine.
Blizzard, dude. It's
that's
awesome.
The way, you know, somebody in Kansas, they don't care about tornadoes. Like, you know, if you live in California, you don't care about earthquakes. I live in North Carolina. I don't care about hurricanes. Bring it on. It's fine. We'll throw some.
I'm terrified of all of those things. I live in total fear every day. I don't even want to leave the house. No, but it is a question. And I, you know, cause I've all often thought like, boy, wouldn't it be great to find a permanent slip somewhere in like Florida, be close to the family, you know, be able to at least enjoy the winter down there. But then, yeah, it's this like constant migration that has to happen. And I've enjoyed doing that for sure. Cause there were a few years where I just took the boat from Maine, brought it to South Carolina. And then at the end of that went back up. And you know, that's not too bad, but sometimes it can. And as I get older and older, it's kind of like, dang it, dude, I got to move that boat again. And there really isn't like this perfect spot on the East Coast that's like, I mean, totally safe, you know?
Not totally safe, but it's, you can go Annapolis in Maryland. And
true.
The storm has to come across the entire Delmarva Peninsula, hit the Chesapeake Bay, and then cross over to Annapolis. You're pretty good. Like, you might be seeing some 75, 80 mile per hour winds. You may see some damage to the boat, but you're not going to get this absolute destruction that you would get sitting on the coast of Florida.
Like, this is true.
You know, Fort Pierce, you know, St. John, like that whole area, like all through that area. When hurricanes hit there, all the boats are gone. You just don't have a boat anymore.
Yeah. Where, yeah.
Unless you're in Wilmington, North Carolina, or you're on the Outer Banks, or you're like in Charleston Harbor in South Carolina, you're pretty much gonna, your odds are a lot better, is all I'm saying. Obviously, boats in the Carolinas, they get taken down by storms too, but it's nothing like what you see. I mean, you see people, I mean, half the people don't even haul out when the storms are coming in because they're like, well, it's more likely to tip over than sink.
Right. Well,
and yeah. the tidal currents aren't as bad, especially when you're in, like, when you're basically the Albemarle and Pamlico Sound are inland waters, really. And I mean, they're brackish, but they're pretty much, you don't get the tidal stuff. You don't, it's, I personally would rather keep my boat in the Carolinas because I considered doing even up in the Chesapeake Bay. And I don't know. I think it's, I feel better about here than anywhere else on the East Coast other than, you know, like Maine, New Hampshire area. And then you have to go to Maine or New Hampshire and it's like a degree up there. So fuck that too.
Hey, shout out to Maine and New Hampshire. I love those states. All right. They're great.
Every time they want to pay me, same thing with Northern Michigan where you live. Every time somebody offers me a check to come to Fargo, Sault Ste. Marie, New Hampshire, Maine, I show up every time. I have never turned down a paid gig in any of those places, but I ain't fucking living there, bro. It's not happening.
Oh man, well, okay, totally get that, and that's it makes sense. I don't know, it has been just sort of on my mind because you do kind of hope that, oh man, maybe there's just like that perfect little Garden of Eden that I can take the boat to and never have to worry about it. But in the end, it's a boat, so there's always going to be a little bit of risk, and as much as that might give you a little bit of anxiety, at the same time, it's part of the adventure. So
Maybe next winter, what you should do is sail it all the way up, come across the Great Lakes, do half the Great Loop. There you go. That could be your next big adventure because you're getting old now, Jerome. You're turning into an old man.
Exactly.
You just bring it across the Great Lakes, and you can just become one of those guys.
I have thought about that. That if it came to the time where I was like, you know, I don't want to do any more of these big ocean trips, but I don't want to sell Sparrow. I always want to keep Sparrow until I die kind of thing. I think having it up in Michigan would be pretty cool. And, you know, you're only going to get to use it for 4 months out of the year. But still, fresh water, you know, you could live on in the marina up here, all that sort of stuff. So I don't know. It has crossed my mind. I don't really think it'll ever happen. It's one of those pipe dreams, you know?
Here's an idea for you just as a fun trip. Do the Great Loop trip, but do speaking engagements along it.
God, I couldn't. Not on Sparrow, dude. That I'd love to do the speaking engagements without question. I just could not. I hate the intercoastal. It's such, because my boat is just for sailing free on an ocean blue, nothing in the way, me down sleeping below, that sort of thing. The intercoastal, I'm hyper focused like I'm on a motorcycle, and it's uncomfortable, and I'm sunburnt, and I'm like, I hate it.
That's the other benefit of Carolina is you've got the Pamlico Sound and you've got the Albemarle Sound that are at their thinnest points are 15, 16 miles across. And then they go 80 miles long. So you can actually get out and sail, and it gets super choppy. The chop can get pretty rough. It can get gnarly, but it's no worse than the Chesapeake. And actually in some ways it's better than the Chesapeake because there's less fetch. So it's a fun place to sail and then sort of feel like you're actually doing something and not have to be quite so paranoid, except when you're coming up the ICW and you have to stay in the canals and those ditches.
Yeah. Adams Creek.
It's weird that those things exist.
I'm glad they do because it is kind of nice to be able to worm your way kind of inland, so to speak. But yeah, it's just West Sail's not made for it. And it's just, I don't know. I've often thought about trying to figure out a way to hook up like a rocking chair that I can like recline into in the cockpit and still have full visual and have like an umbrella over my head and be able to sort of manipulate where I'm going. Cause I'm just standing there like I'm at the helm about ready to pull up to a dock, but I have to do it for like 25 hours. And I'm just like,
if you drop your Dodger, if you lower your Dodger, you still mm-hmm. have to stand.
No, when I drop my Dodger, I see what you're saying. Not really, I guess. I have a big beanbag chair in the boat, so I usually sit on that. But yeah, I don't know. See, you got the pulpit up there. You got and I'm always worried that I'm gonna run over either a buoy for a crab pot or you know something. So and I don't have a depth sounder on the boat, so the whole time I'm just waiting till I feel a little bump.
See, you need to learn to be a sailor, Jerome, which, you know, you're an offshoresman. You need to become a sailor where you literally never get out of sight of land.
A coastal cruiser.
You would never not have a depth sounder. Like, it's just irresponsible. No, I understand you live in thousands of feet of water, but.
Yeah, you don't need a depth sounder on a boat. You should know where you are and how deep it is around you at all times.
Lead line.
I did. I've had to use one of those before where I anchored. Well, hey, James, this has been phenomenal. We're over an hour now, and I do want to give you a chance, though, to just talk a little bit about your comedy and all the socials and all that sort of stuff. So please take a couple minutes. Just plug anything and everything you want, man.
Look, if just Google James Hodge comedy, you'll find all of it. It's all right there. I'm not hard to find. What I want you guys to really be doing, though, is spread the word about what Jerome's doing. Like, share his stuff. Like, get it. Like, the reality is there's a lot of us out there that enjoy your content, but I don't think we're evangelical enough when it comes to spreading the word about the stuff that you're doing. Like, you should be up there with Sam Holmes in terms of the audience that you have. Like, you should be. You don't have a half-naked girl in the boat with you, so you're not going to get millions
of numbers. Yes, like, I know. I understand that. But there's limits.
You've sailed around the world now. Maybe now is time for you to bring in your bikini-clad coast guard.
We tried to do that this year. I couldn't put the boat in because I couldn't get new sails. But
I'm just saying, it's like, do you want a free catamaran or not? That's all I'm saying.
Not if I have to do that. Oh, good. Well, I appreciate that, James, for sure. Well, and I hope to be able to do more of these, and hopefully, you know, you and I will be able to sit down for a one-on-one in-person interview this summer when we're at the boatyard, because I really want to discuss a lot about the comedy and about being on stage, because that's something that I'm slowly progressing into, and it's one of those things where it's so fun to do. It's nerve-wracking as you lead up to a gig. When you're doing it, it's awesome. Afterwards, you feel like a king, and so it's this roller coaster of emotions that I love, and I'm telling a story that I've lived. You're up there with this material you've just created, and like, the people are either going to like it or they're not. And that's amazing.
It's pretty autobiographical. Like, stand-ups, it's not like I'm going up there solving all the world's problems or anything. Like, it's
true.
It's dick jokes about friends and family. You know, it's not that complicated.
Well, I really look forward to a chance to get into some of that. And have you back on the show, my friend.
All right, man. I'll talk to you later. This was fun.
All right. Thanks.
All right.
See ya.
Yeah.